today, we received a tremendous vote of confidence from the citizens of Israel. It became clear once again that the Likud is the largest party in Israel by a significant margin above all other parties. And I must point out that our partners in the national camp won very impressive achievements.
Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu speaking yesterday after the elections this week. Today, the country's current prime minister, Yair Lapid, conceded, meaning Netanyahu is set to become the prime minister again after he was ousted last year over allegations of corruption and bribery. He made his comeback by forming the most right-wing coalition in the country's history. His victory comes as Brazil's leftist leader Lula barely beat the far-right incumbent Jair Bolsonaro this week. Right-wing candidates still won the majority in Brazil's Congress and most governorships. In Europe, Italy now has a far-right leader. The far-right has made gains in places you wouldn't expect in Europe, like Sweden, Norway, and Switzerland. And here in the United States, Republicans are expected to win back the House in next week's midterms. Many of them are Trump loyalists who deny the 2020 election results. So why are voters across the globe flocking toward right-wing populists? Joining us to talk about this is Jason Stanley, philosophy professor at Yale and author of the book How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Welcome back to Press Play, Jason.
Thank you so much. Good to be on, although dark times.
Yes. Well, I want to begin with Israel. Netanyahu was ousted last year, as I said, over allegations of corruption. Apparently, voters did not find that to be exclusionary again. He's expected to return to his old job stronger than ever after he formed this coalition with far-right religious groups. Describe this new coalition and what they want for Israel.
Well, they've got Itamar Ben-Gvir in the party, who is a Kahanist. He represents a Kahanist party. Meir Kahan favored restricting democratic rights to Jewish citizens of Israel, making non-Jewish, Palestinian citizens of Israel into second-class citizens, which is the sort of hallmark of fascism, to have an ethno-nationalist citizenship criterion, where, like the Nuremberg laws. I mean, we Jews suffered that in Germany. My father lost his citizenship due to these kinds of laws. So Gvir is really has promoted a vision of Israel where non-Jews are second-class citizens, really a fascist vision of Israel. Netanyahu, who's corrupt and has been credibly accused of corruption, is coming back, linking himself to these extreme far-right ultra-nationalist leaders. And what we can expect is a kind of shaping of Israeli policy where non-Jewish citizens are second-class citizens.
Well, and Netanyahu says, well, he'll make the decision. He's not going to abide by all of the policies that Ben-Gvir and the other far-right nationalists adhere to. But how will he be able to do that if he has formed this coalition with them?
That's to be seen. I think his main interest will be protecting himself from prosecution. Obviously, he's going to interfere with the Supreme Court. It's a kind of foreshadowing of what we'll get if and when Trump returns to power in 2024, where you have a corrupt leader who's arguably violated many laws and is in charge again. And so the rule of law is breaking down all across the world. And we're getting these kinds of two systems of norms, one for the corrupt leaders where they can do whatever they want, and another for the rest of us.
Right. So Netanyahu and his allies campaigned on overhauling the judiciary, specifically the laws that are being used to prosecute him. And so he would then escape prosecution from these corruption allegations?
That's right. And that's what we're seeing. You know, the first thing you do is capture the courts if you want to capture the country in a one-party state, an authoritarian one-party state. This classic structure that was described about fascism, where you have two sets of norms. You have one set of norms for the leader and his friends, where they can kind of do anything, and another set of norms for the ordinary citizens. And that's what it looks like Israel is headed for.
But why would voters want that then?
Ethno-nationalism far-right ethno-nationalism is having a moment in the world today, as we can see. Voters, what law and order means for far-right ethno-nationalists is not the same as rule of law. For far-right ethno-nationalism, law and order means one set of laws for them and another set of laws for us. They are criminals by nature. I mean, the Republicans in the United States are doing their old shtick about, you know, oh, violent crime is surging, even though it's, you know, pretty approaching historic lows. But they're doing that because that vocabulary of law and order, it doesn't mean law and order. It means, you know, when we run things, that's law and order. When they run things, that's criminality.
So voters would prefer to have a strong man who may be ethically or legally compromised because they fear for their own safety in these turbulent times.
Well, time and time again, when elites bring us into crisis, when there's massive change, generational conflict, social and economic inequality, there's a chance to make things better. Or there's a chance to like get back at your enemy at minorities and get this kind of pleasure at punishing minorities and perceived opponents. And that kind of politics wins again and again. Hitler came to power in an election. Mussolini came to power in a normal way. In times of when elites fail, as they have so clearly done in the United States, leaving us with massive wealth inequality, then people often go for the strongman. That's right.
And yet you see in places where there is a pretty healthy standard of living in Sweden or Switzerland, Norway even, you see even in these countries an appeal of fascist leaders or the far right. So how do you account for that in countries that are relatively well off and the income disparity isn't as great and there is a strong social welfare state?
That's a great point. One of my favorite points. It's very important that we see this as cultural as well. Sweden, what we see is racism again and again. Here in the United States, in Sweden, in Europe, we see Sweden has quickly moved from becoming sort of an all-white country to much more diverse. And politicians are able to use that to run against that diversity, to represent democracy and human rights as kind of liberalism as an enemy because it allows for that diversity. So there's cultural shifts along gender lines, along racial lines. White Americans, white Swedes are no longer everything. They have to give a little bit of power. Men have to give a little bit of power to women. These changes bring with them also cultural dislocation that results in backlash. We Americans are very familiar with white backlash. That's what they're having in Sweden right now. You're making, which is absolutely right, is it's not merely economic. Racial backlash is real. And we see that again and again in the United States, where every time there's a movement for Black equality, there's a harsh white backlash.
Right, right. Okay. And then here in the United States, since we brought it to this point, you do have a lot of election denying and refusals to concede. Anti-democracy seems to be on the rise here. How do you walk it back at this point? How do you put the genie, if you will, back in the bottle once it's out, either here or in any other country?
Well, I think you're asking the most important question. I think, you know, 5 years ago when some of us were talking about fascism and the threat to democracy, we regarded it as alarmists, but now it's just the facts. Everybody sees it. It's the analysis is done. It's pretty clear what we face. We face many politicians bragging about how they're not going to let Democrats win an election in their state ever again. They're going to end democracy. That's what they're running on. So how do we roll that back? That's if I had the solution to that, democracy is a very fragile thing. And history shows that democracies are kind of, they don't last that, you know, they, they, they're, they're prone to a lot of internal instability because unprincipled politicians in the pay of big business or oligarchs can turn the population against each other, against minority groups. You turn them against racial minorities. If you don't have racial minorities, you turn them against LGBT. You do everything together. And you blame equality on democracy. Now, how you roll that back, how you show that democracy isn't your enemy, democracy's liberties aren't threatening your children, democracy's liberties should be preserved for your children, that's a great question. We've been here before. The civil rights movement wrested democracy out of the claws of the Jim Crow South. So we've been here before, but it's hard. It's really hard.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much.
Jason Stanley, philosophy professor at Yale and author of the book, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Coming up, holiday travel promises to be a doozy. Prices are way up. We'll tell you about that next on Press Play.